Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
The next case on our calendar for oral argument is Terry Curtin et al. Versus R.S. Eden. Counsel, while you are getting settled, I'll remind you that you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And counsel for respondent, are there two of you making arguments today?
Just me, Your Honor, Brian Hansen.
And who's with you at Co-
Kevin Mosier from the firm, who's been on the case,
okay.
But I'll be arguing.
All right, perfect. Just wanted to make sure I was giving everybody time. We have some special guests today, students from, is it Maple Grove High School? Welcome. So when you are ready, I'll also just advise that the podium can be raised and lowered. There's a button under the middle of it to meet your needs. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rick McPherson. I am a staff attorney with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, a nonprofit program of legal aid, which provides free legal representation for people with disabilities in Minnesota. I'm here today representing Terry Curtin and Rosanna Plaza, who are here in the courtroom with the assistance of an ASL interpreter provided by the court. I'm here today to ask this court to reverse the decision of the district court, which denied Ms. Curtin and Ms. Plaza the right to pursue their legal claims against respondent, even though they have a debatably meritorious claim, and as the district court found, the failure to file their lawsuit was not their fault, and respondent will not suffer any prejudice if their lawsuit is allowed to continue. Today, I intend to start with the issue of whether the appellants have stated a debatably meritorious claim, and then address the question of excusable neglect. In other words, whether the appellants are responsible for the error of their attorney. The claims appellants asserted in their complaint are debatably meritorious. I believe they are meritorious, but reasonable people can certainly debate their merits, as the parties in this case are doing.
Isn't the issue really whether this halfway house constitutes a place of public accommodation? I mean, that really is a legal issue, not so much a factual dispute.
Am I correct? That is correct. The allegations in plaintiff's complaint concerning the actions of the respondent in failing to provide a video phone service and interpreter service normally states a meritorious Minnesota Human Rights Act claim, and the court is right. The issue here is simply whether it is debatably clear that the respondent is covered as a public accommodation by the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Let me ask you a question about that. Are the relevant provisions, and I assume that would be the definition of public accommodation, in the Minnesota Human Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, are they similar so that the interpretations of the ADA would be useful to guide our legal interpretation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act?
Yes, they are. And as the Minnesota Supreme Court and the Eighth Circuit have both held, this court should look to the federal law for guidance in interpreting the provisions and the requirements, and in this case, the definition of what a public accommodation is. There is one significant difference, however. The ADA is actually slightly narrower in its definition of a public accommodation than the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The ADA lists a number of specific kinds of businesses that will be considered public accommodations. The Minnesota legislature chose not to go in that direction. It defined public accommodations extremely broadly. It was intended to cover all kinds of private businesses, whether licensed or not, and as I'll discuss in a moment, whether they have eligibility requirements or not. The starting point.
So just a question on public accommodation. How does a county jail or lockup?
The Minnesota Human Rights Act divides entities into two categories, what they call public services, which are governmental entities, and public accommodations, which are private businesses. A jail, a county jail, is a public service. The requirements, in this case, of providing access to telephone services and to interpreters is essentially the same. And that's why there's, in my mind, a level of difficulty with the district court's decision.
But the difference between public service and place of public accommodation is the fact that our case law has held that there is, that when considering whether a place is a public accommodation, we look at the selectiveness of the group in admitting. I mean, and the existence of limits on number of people who can access the business, the facility. I mean, I understand accommodation is, itself is broadly defined, but the notion of what's public versus what's private has to do with the criteria for admission and then selectivity and things like that. And that distinguishes the public accommodation from the public service, doesn't it?
Well, that is what the Master Shield case, Wayne versus Master Shield, decided a number of years ago.
And the JCs versus McClure, I mean.
JCs versus McClure decided something different. At that point, the court was trying to determine whether a membership organization was even covered. The JCs was a membership.
But in terms of the public-private distinction, I mean, you know, Wayne versus Master Shield harkened back to that other case,
right?
Correct.
But what the court decided in the JCs case, it was that the JCs was a business. It first had to get to that point, and it decided that because anybody, it offered its memberships on a broad basis, it was a business. In this case, the respondent, there's no question that it's a business. It has revenues of over $13 million. It is not a club like the JCs is. My clients were not members of Reentry Minnesota. They were clients.
So, Mr. McPherson, it seems to me that, I mean, I'm agreeing with you to this point that the issue before us isn't whether this is a business, but that last phrase in the definition of place of public accommodation, made available to the public, otherwise, you know. So what test, if it's not the one set out in Wayne, should we use to determine whether those services are made available to the public?
I think the standard is whether at some point anybody in the general public could use those services. And I think a very important point for this court to consider is that the Master Shield decision, on which the district court based its decision, was decided before the Supreme Court of the United States decided the PGA Tours versus Casey Martin case. It's usually known as the Casey Martin. Most people think of that case in terms of the issue of whether providing a golf cart would fundamentally alter the game of golf. That was part of that the final holding. But before it could get to that issue, it had to decide whether the PGA Tours was a public accommodation under the act.
But I thought the PGA didn't dispute that it was they didn't argue that they were a private club exempt from the ADA, did they?
The Supreme Court spent a great deal of its decision addressing that fact, and whether it was a public accommodation or not, because it couldn't get to the question of whether it the PGA Tours needed to provide a reasonable accommodation. If it was not, and I've cited the portions of the Supreme Court's decision that specifically address that. And what is important about the Casey Martin decision that was different than MasterShield, and the court in MasterShield did not have the benefit of the Supreme Court's teaching, was that the PGA Tours had very explicit and very limiting eligibility requirements. You could not participate in, I couldn't just walk off the street and start to play in a PGA tournament. I had to meet certain eligibility requirements. There were fees involved. There were qualifying tournaments I had to participate in. So what the Supreme Court, said was, look, anybody could go through that process at any point in time if somebody paid the money and met the other qualifying conditions, they could play. In that sense, it was open to the general public. That is the same thing that applies in the eligibility aspect of this case.
I just struggle with those lines of cases that seem to me to be dealing with memberships, kind of that you know, organizations that aren't tied to a physical spot, which it strikes me should be different. And so I wanted to ask you about that. And it also, I also struggle with the fact that this seems much more like a public service in so many ways. And people are directed there by, you know, by the courts, by probation. They're not there usually, I assume, because they want to be. You know, and so why wasn't it, and I assume that you didn't proceed in the public service realm of the Human Rights Act just because it wasn't being paid for by the public, even though there were the funds coming in. So have you seen any other cases that talk about this, that perhaps this phrase made available to the public, that we should be looking at kind of the public service aspect of what's being provided?
No, but I mean, there are no cases except, I mean, the reason why it was not pled as a public service case is because there is a line of federal cases that says a private entity that contracts with the government does not become a public service. But I think your perception is correct. This is an entity that provides the same service that a jail provides. And in fact, in Ms. Curtin's situation, she'd been in a jail. They provided the video phones. I know why they provided the video phones, because I've been involved in litigation about that. They provided video phones eventually, or they allowed her to use some video phones. They still did not provide an interpreter, although other jails in Minnesota do. Then she came back to court, and she had a choice. She could have returned to jail or to a halfway house. The halfway house that's providing the same service now did not provide those services and claims today, oh, we don't have to do that. We can discriminate against anybody. And please make no mistake, this is not a case just about people with disabilities.
So can I take you back to follow up on question and go back to Wayne. Is Wayne still the right test then, or are you saying we should look at something else in determining whether this, clearly this is an accommodation, it's a facility, it's a business, but the question is private versus public. What do we look for to answer that question?
I think you look for whether ultimately anybody in the general public could use those services. And in this case, anybody could.
Be arrested and held and have a court order them there.
That is correct.
That strikes me as even more selective than the apartment building in Wayne, but you're suggesting Wayne is not an appropriate test.
No, and in part because it really is a different kind of situation. In many respects, Wayne, the apartment building there, is much more like a club, and that's the way the court talked about it. It talked about it as there are only certain people. Once you were there, there were only certain people who could live there and who could allow their guests to come in. The very troubling aspect of this, to me, is that the respondent is asking this court to affirm the principle that it does not have to provide accommodations. It can discriminate on the basis of race, on the basis of gender, and on the basis of and against people with
disabilities. There's no other licensing requirement. I mean, they're a licensed, you know, heavily regulated sort of entity.
Right.
There are no other rules that would address these issues?
Yes. The Minnesota Human Rights Act explicitly says it covers businesses licensed or not licensed. The licensing piece...
You're suggesting that if we agree with the district court that the message to R.S. Eden is that they can discriminate against anybody.
That is correct, that they will not file...
And I'm asking, are there any other than the Human Rights Act, any other regulations or licensing statutes that would suggest that that's not true?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
If I may, Mr. McPherson, turning to Ms. Plaza's claim, if this panel, I'm not suggesting that we are, but would determine that Reentry Metro is a public accommodation, how should we handle that claim? Do we have to remand? Is that something we could decide? And specifically, could you address the Kruger case? Because I read that as probably saying, you know, well, she just doesn't have standing.
Ms. Plaza's
yes.
case? This court should decide that at this stage of litigation, certainly, Ms. Plaza has pled a debatably meritorious claim that there is a long line of federal cases, including cases in this district that I've cited to in the brief, Ball in particular, that have held that Ms. Plaza has an independent claim and that she has standing.
But those are federal cases, which I understand can be very persuasive, but doesn't the Kruger decision from 2010 in the Minnesota Supreme Court suggest otherwise?
I don't believe so. I believe this court should look to the federal cases and the interpretation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which gives a cause of action to any person who has been harmed by discrimination, a private right of action, and gives them standing. And as we have shown, Ms. Plaza has been harmed.
All right, thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Joyce, I've noticed that the red or the yellow light doesn't go on until there's a minute left. Is there a way? Usually it's when it's 5 minutes. I don't know how it is showing on the podium, but as I'm monitoring it up here, I'm not seeing the yellow until you're down to the last minute of your argument. So I just be mindful your time is passing, even if the yellow light doesn't come on when
Certainly
it should.
Not.
So you may proceed now, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Brian Hansen on behalf of the respondent, R.S. Eden. To have the judgment against them vacated, it was incumbent on the appellants to prove to the district court that they're entitled to relief under all four of the factors of Fenton v. Klaas. So when appellant's counsel argues that the district court granted or denied their relief even though we're not prejudiced, that's absolutely correct. We acknowledge we weren't prejudiced by this. We do dispute two of the factors, and winning on any one of them, either one of them, grants us relief here, gets us the order we want. We dispute, and the district court agreed with us, that appellants ever had a meritorious claim. Our reentry metro is not a public accommodation, as that has ever been applied under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. We dispute, and the district court agreed that they have a reasonable excuse for failing to file their complaint within the one-year deadline of Rule 5.04A.
Mr. Hansen, if you would, could you address the first question I asked Mr. McPherson, looking at as far as the meritorious claim, and that is, are the relevant provisions defining a public accommodation under the Minnesota Human Rights Act and the ADA similar, so that interpretations of the ADA would be useful to guide our interpretation of the Human Rights Act?
They are similar. They're certainly not identical, and I don't think we need to look to the ADA in this case. Minnesota courts absolutely look to federal law when it would be helpful, when we don't have a clear interpretation of our law, or when they're very similar. In this case, we know what the law is, and we have, I think, a clear precedent from Minnesota courts of what a public accommodation is. That comes from starting with the JC's case in 1981 and was fleshed out more in Wayne v. MasterShield.
Well, the reason I ask is I was looking at the guidance from the Justice Department on the ADA. I think it was originally published in 1991. And you know, you're familiar, I'm sure, with those kind of 12. It's not as all-encompassing. It does say here are these 12 areas that can be public accommodations. One of them are social service centers. And the guidance from the Justice Department says that that would include not only the Citizen Center homeless shelters, but also other establishments such as substance abuse treatment centers, rape crisis centers, and halfway houses. So if they're similar, shouldn't we be guided by the Department of Justice guidance of the ADA, which specifically addresses halfway houses, which, you know, we don't have any specific guidance on that in Minnesota law?
Your Honor, we don't have a specific case on halfway houses. I think we have significant guidance in the line of cases of what constitutes a public accommodation that we can apply here. And I don't think we need to look to the ADA or the Department of Justice or federal case law when we have that on the Minnesota law.
We don't have any Minnesota. Oh, are you talking about the Wayne case then? You're coming back to that.
No, not specifically. I was just talking. Yeah, the Wayne case sets it out. The Wayne case was 1999. And I would argue that if Minnesota legislature disagreed with that opinion, if any Minnesota court disagreed with that and thought we should go with the ADA, there have been now 20 years, roughly, where something could have been done and nothing has. The standard as set out in Wayne, selectivity of membership and limits on size, is still good law in Minnesota, and that's how we interpret the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
Now, Mr. McPherson argues that the Casey Martin case changed the analysis, and whether we agree or not, why shouldn't we, 20 years later, look at a broader test and look, as Mr. McPherson suggests, at whether at some point anyone in the general public could access the halfway house facility and its services?
First, I would argue I think that's beyond the purview or the scope of what we're doing here today. We're looking at whether the district court abused its discretion when it analyzed the law that was before it. I don't think we're here to change the law in any way. I think that's beyond the scope of the analysis today. And I don't think we have any guidance or reason to address or change the law. Again, that Casey Martin case came out a year after Wayne v. MasterShield. Wayne v. MasterShield is still, as I said, has been around.
But it just strikes me there's a real difference between an apartment complex and a halfway house where who comes and goes is, you know, directed by the courts and probation. I mean, those are just very different entities.
They are different entities. For sure, I would argue, however, that the halfway house is more restrictive as an apartment building. And so if we're using the Wayne v. MasterShield case, it stands to reason, I think, with greater force that a halfway house is not in a public accommodation as opposed to an apartment complex.
But at least in the apartment complex, the owners of that apartment complex are controlling kind of the limitations on size and or at least the selectivity of membership, whereas here you have kind of an outside force, the public sector, really, controlling that, correct?
That's true, and I'm not aware of any law that says that dictates who is in charge of the selectivity. I think in this case, it is still a highly selective matter. You don't get in unless you have a criminal conviction. In the case of Reentry Metro, you don't get in unless you're a woman. You don't get in unless you're sent there by the courts or probation. And when we look at limits on size, 26 beds. So within the guideline that's been set out in the JC's case and in the Wayne v. MasterShield case, I think it stands to reason that much more than an apartment building, a halfway house is not a public accommodation.
It seems we're almost going forward with the idea that the second Findon factor is not met here.
The reasonable excuse?
Yeah.
I was hoping to get to that soon, but
I just wanted your position on that.
Certainly. I think appellants would have the court believe that the error of attorney can never be attributed to the client, and that is just not the law. That's not the case. We know that from the Cole case that we cite that says specifically, not all errors, even if committed by an attorney, are excusable. Sorry, let me get to my section of the outline on that.
Well, it seems to me that the early case law, you know, on this rule of filing within a year, supported what you're saying now, but it seems like over time that we give the client more slack in this area. Would you agree?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would actually say it's the other way around. We have the Cole and the Gams case that went up to the Supreme Court. Those were cases that were at least both remanded because the rule was new, and in one, the attorney didn't know the rule had been enacted. In another, the attorney knew of the rule but didn't think it applied to a case that had been pending when the rule went in. Now we're getting cases like the one we cite. They're unpublished cases for the most part, but the Siegel case where an attorney, and that's 2018, didn't file within a year, and that was not excusable neglect. They offered no explanation.
Well, here we have an explanation, and I mean, it's one that can happen. It was a clerical error. It slipped through the cracks, and that happens. I have a harder time thinking the district court exercised its discretion appropriately with respect to the second Findon factor.
Your Honor, I don't think I would call this a clerical error. A clerical error is what happened in, for example, the Wynn case that they cite where the parties thought they had filed a complaint or filed their request for renewed de novo. Everybody proceeded as had, and an assistant messed up the filing. But
it's a technical error in the sense that, as a general rule, someone has some sort of a tickler system that you put something into so that you have a computer tracking when various deadlines are upon you, and obviously this didn't get into that.
Certainly, Your Honor, I would clarify that or qualify that as forgetfulness. I mean, that's what appellant's counsel acknowledged at the district court in the transcript. The reason this wasn't filed is I forgot. Forgetfulness, we quote the Whipple v. Mahler case, Minnesota Supreme Court. It's an old case, but it says very clearly forgetfulness is not excusable neglect. At the end of all this, that's all they have. They forgot to file the complaint. And then I think we need to look at the overall facts of this case. This was not a case that was being diligently pursued. I lay it out in the complaint, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but after they served the complaint, that was 7 months before we heard from them again. And we only heard from them after I served initial disclosures and initial discovery to try and get this moving. That was deemed premature. But there was a seven-month gap with no word from appellants or from their counsel. Once we did get this going, they needed an extension to serve initial disclosures in October, 9 months after the complaint was served. They needed an extension to serve discovery responses in December. When we finally got discovery responses on December 31st, they weren't verified. The last I heard from them was on December 31st. I will get you verified responses when I have them. Next I heard was March when the complaint was filed. They argue in their brief that we are scheduling depositions. We were not scheduling depositions. I did not hear a word about who they wanted to depose or what dates they wanted to be available. They argue we were engaged in settlement discussions. We received a settlement demand in October, and that was it. That was the only discussions we had on the issue. So under these facts, where they were not diligently pursuing their claim, I don't think it can be said the district court abused its really broad discretion on this when it determined the forgetfulness was not excusable.
Counsel, I have in my memory for some reason a case we heard in Rochester 2 or 3 years ago when the rule was new where the parties were actively involved in settlement discussions at the time the deadline passed. And I might be remembering it wrong, but I don't think we cut the plaintiffs any slack on that case. Is that one that you found?
I don't recall that case. I have found a couple cases unpublished from this court in recent years where the failure to file was not inexcusable. That's the Siegel case that I cited, and that is another recent case, Larson v. Tessier from 2018, where there was a failure to file in the complaint within a year. The ruling from this court, the fact that an attorney committed the mistake leading to the adverse order or judgment is not legally dispositive. A district court is required to make a fact-intensive analysis. That's what happened here. The district court opened its analysis by saying, I agree that normally we don't like to hold the clients responsible for their attorney's mistakes, but under these facts, and there were several pages of factual findings in the order, under these facts, I don't find this to be excusable neglect. Again, the district court has broad discretion. I don't think there's any basis to overturn that discretion here.
Mr. Hansen, if I may go back to the meritorious claim, Findon factor, and talk about Ms. Plaza's claim. If, and I understand you would disagree with this, but if the panel were to determine that Reentry Metro is a place of public accommodation, how should we handle her claim? Because I think then, would we remand? Would we reach the issue, I think, that you briefed to the district court on standing? Could you provide your perspective?
I think under these circumstances where the district court didn't address the issue, it would have to be a remand. If you were to find that it's a public accommodation, I think it would be sent back to the district court to decide specifically Ms. Plaza's
case. Because there are factual issues involving the standing?
Correct. I want to also go back to the meritorious claim to address a couple issues that counsel here raised. He raised passionately that if we find that RSE is not a public accommodation, it's free to discriminate against anyone. That's not the case. There are rules that apply to halfway houses. They are monitored by the Department of Corrections. There are requirements that they have procedures in place to provide programs and treatment to all residents. They don't qualify by race. If they don't do that, they lose their license.
What rules address accommodating disabilities?
There's not one that specifically says disabilities. It doesn't specifically say disabilities or race. There is one specifically for religion. What they do say is provide programs for all residents. And more to the point, to the extent that is the issue, again, it's, I think, beyond the scope of what we're doing today. We're not saying what rules should apply to a halfway house or what's fair to it. We're saying, does the Minnesota Human Rights specifically apply? To the extent there's something else that should be done in terms of rules for halfway houses, we need to go through the legislature for that. That is not, I think, a course for today, at least. Here. And then finally, around to the last point I have is going back to this Martin case, where counsel was addressing the selectivity of it. I don't remember which one of you judges I asked, but about the PGA, they did acknowledge that it was a public accommodation in that case. And the real point of that case, to the extent the Supreme Court did address how open it was, what it was is to get into qualifying school, you needed $3,000 and two letters of recommendation. And that's it. That's what that case was about. Could Casey Martin use a golf cart in those last stages of the qualifying school? And then if he did well enough, go on to the PGA. But that is not limits that the PGA set, the qualifications other than the $3,000. That's not highly selective, as that has ever been applied under Wayne v. MasterShield or the JC's case. That is not anything that we should apply here. And again, as I said, Wayne v. MasterShield has been around. Even though the Martin case came a year later, we've had Wayne v. MasterShield for 20 years. It is still good law in this state. And so ultimately, Your Honor, as I've said, there are four required factors. If we win on just one of these, the district court's order has to be affirmed. I do think under these facts, the district court didn't just stay within its discretion. It was absolutely right on both counts, and I would ask the order be affirmed in total, unless you have any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. McPherson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'd like to first address the issue of whether my clients have asserted a meritorious claim. And I'd like to call the court's attention to what is a public accommodation. And there's no question that institutions like private schools, private universities, are places of public accommodation. They're not listed in the Minnesota Human Rights Act because, as I said, the legislature chose not to go in the direction of listing. They are explicitly included in the ADA. And
Their own category of educational institutions.
No, the ADA does not have
category. But the Human Rights Act does have it as a separate category of entities,
right,
if you will, to which anti-discrimination law applies.
Right. And the Human Rights Act, if you're a public accommodation in Minnesota, you're covered by both parts of the act. That there are aspects of the public accommodation section that deal with access, physical access, barriers, things like interpreters, that are not really addressed in the education section of the Human Rights Act. That deals with the education aspect. My point here is that the private schools, private universities, have very selective eligibility criteria. I cannot just walk into McAllister College or Mitchell Hamlin School of Law sit down at a desk and start taking classes. I have to meet their eligibility requirements, and those are highly selective. Nevertheless, they are covered entities under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. That is the problem with this eligibility test that MasterShield attempted to set up. I think MasterShield needs to be limited to its specific facts, to the kind of entity that was involved. Otherwise, it's opening a very large potential exception in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. What kinds of eligibility criteria would exclude some entity from coverage under the Act? What size would exclude? I submit that the Minnesota legislature already addressed that issue, at least as to size, by adopting the defense of undue financial burden. If an entity is so small that it cannot afford a specific accommodation, then that is a defense it can assert and should assert. That is not present in this case, by the way. This is an entity whose revenue was over $13 million. We're not, that defense is not present.
You know, earlier Judge Jetson asked a question that basically got to the issue of, is it a public accommodation where someone is directed by the criminal justice system to an entity rather than voluntarily choosing to enter the PGA or choosing to rent an apartment in a building? Isn't that something that's distinguishable?
It does. That's not a criteria that takes it out of the category of being a public accommodation.
Why not, if in all the cases the person seeking to use the public accommodation is doing so voluntarily?
Because, as I said, the legislature chose to divide all entities into two categories. You're either a public service, a governmental entity, or you're a public accommodation. There's no, at least as federal law has developed, the respondent is not a public service. It doesn't become a public service by accepting contracts or even having somebody doing business with the governmental entity. It is still a private entity. It's owned privately. In conclusion, what I guess I would like to say to the court is this is not a question, at least as to the meritoriousness of my client's claim. That's not a matter of discretion for the district court. The district court was making a decision of law. That is not subject to the abuse of discretion standard. That is something this court has to review specifically. In this case, we submit that the district court made an error in interpreting the Minnesota Human Rights Act. This court should reverse the decision of the district court. As to the question of Ms. Plaza's claim, this court could send that back to the district court, but I would suggest that should not be decided in a Rule 50 motion where there is no record. Both of these legal claims involve very serious questions about the extent and the scope of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And for reviewing courts, there should be an adequate record to decide what is the scope of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. For the purpose of this Rule 50 motion, my clients met their burden of showing that their claims were at least debatably meritorious. For that reason, I believe, and I request that this court reverse the decision of the district court.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful argument. The case was well submitted. We'll take it under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you. matter on the calendar for oral argument is